Okay. So we've just read Deuteronomy 6:4 to 7:11. We're going to pause and talk about this section before we go on to the prophetic section of Zechariah 14:9. And then we'll discuss how the two are connected. So, as I said, these Deuteronomy 6:4, of course, is a very iconic passage. We know it well as the Shema. Hear, O Israel. Another thing I wanted to remind us of is the nature of the book of Deuteronomy. Let me just ask out there, how is the book of Deuteronomy built? Has anybody thought about the structure of Deuteronomy before? Can you tell me what it's like?
Well, it's a recap of history.
Yeah, it's a recap.
So in that sense, it's got a historical framework.
Yeah. What could you compare Deuteronomy to in its world, in the ancient Near East?
Contract.
Similar. We have another word. What do you have between two kings when they have an agreement? What do we call it?
Treaty.
Treaty. And the book of Deuteronomy is built like a treaty. We have compared it to, you could compare it to two kinds of treaties. The treaty form in the ancient Near East has been in existence basically since we have found writing. You know, it's very old. But we have specifically two types. There's the old Hittite kind of treaty. And in many ways, the book of Deuteronomy resembles that. And then there's the later Assyrian, we'll call it Neo-Assyrian type. And they kind of modified it because they were like a big superpower. So I just want to throw that out there as a structure, so we see where our section fits into it. In a treaty, you have two kings. And usually, there's a suzerain, which is the top king, and a vassal, which is the servant king. So a big king, a little king. And
what did you call the
suzerain?
Vassal?
Suzerain.
Suzerain.
And I've only used that word in connection to treaties, so it's really not part of my regular vocabulary.
That's why we don't know.
But it doesn't matter. The big strong king and the little dependent king. And in our case, the book of Deuteronomy is a covenant with God, but it's presented to us as a treaty. And there's no other literature out there that ever has a treaty with God, by the way. This book, the Bible, is unique in that. So it's taken a known form. Well, I mean, it's cognizant. It's using a known form in political sphere between humans, and it's giving you that to connect to God.
When you say no other book, you mean no other book but the Bible?
Right.
You're not saying
like that. We can see a lot of similarities with the book of Deuteronomy in its structure to a treaty.
Right.
But there's no other treaty in the ancient Near East that has a people group having a treaty with God. It's always a king and a king. That makes sense. So Deuteronomy is unique. It's saying, hey, you guys know what a treaty looks like between a big king and a little king. Well, now I'm going to tell you what our covenant with God looks like by using treaty language. So God is our big king, and we're the little kings that are obeying the big king. So in a Hittite treaty, there were six parts, you could say. It started with a preamble that gave you the official title of the king. It moved on to a historical prologue that recounted all the good things that that king had done for you. And why would you do this?
To remember how good he is.
It's to establish his authority.
Faithful.
I have been good to you in the past, and that's why you need to listen to me. So we have the preamble, historical prologue. Then you have your treaty terms, or what some people call stipulations. So these would be the commandments, the imperatives. Then you have the requirement that you need to put a copy in the temple. Like if it's between two kings, each king would put it in the temple of their god. And then you invoke divine witnesses. There's got to be a witness to a treaty. And so let's say it's between two kings. They have their gods. So they call, each king calls on their gods to witness the treaty. And then the last section is blessings and curses, which is if you follow the treaty, you will get blessings. If you break the treaty, you will get curses.
In political...
Yes. So between pagan kings, they all have their little gods, right? They invoke them to be the witness for this treaty. And hey, if you break this treaty, my god this or this is going to come do this to you.
Sure, this is fantastic.
So as we read through Deuteronomy, I just thought it would be good to keep that in our mind because it does help us understand parts of Deuteronomy, especially as we get to the end.
And the festivals are about the middle. Would that be part of the treaty? The festival, Passover, Sukkot, everything like that?
That's the historical
kind of treaty?
Well, stipulations, the terms.
Well, no, it's the prologue. It's the historical.
Well, there can be both. Should I write those really quick up here?
I'll take them.
You've got them? Okay. Tell them to me then.
Starts with the preamble.
Yes.
And then the prologue, which is historical, to show how good he's been in the past. Then the third is the stipulation, the treaty terms. And then there's copies to the temple of each of their gods. Then witnesses to the treaty. And finally, the blessings and curses, if you follow or don't follow whatever has been laid down.
Okay. Okay, so then the Assyrians came along, and they said, we are the big, strong people. They had a little more power, so they decided to just cut down on this. They had the preamble saying who the king is and their titles, but they said, we don't need a historical prologue. We already rule, like, we don't have to explain ourselves. Just skip that. So they got rid of that. So the Assyrians, they kept this, they skipped that, the terms, copies in temple. Well, actually, maybe they combined those. Let's see how I... Yeah. So preamble, stipulations, appeal to divine witnesses. And then, let's do this. This. So I'm starring all the Assyrian ones. Preamble, terms, witnesses. Said skip the blessings, we'll just give you curses if you break it. So the blessing for keeping it is that you don't get the curses. And the Assyrians added on many long and distinguished curses. And the reason I mention this now is when we get to chapter 28, you will find a long chapter full of curses. So in that sense, Deuteronomy lines up with the Assyrians in their extent of curses listed. Of course, there's also many blessings listed. And even within those curses, some of the curses themselves are exactly like the ones in the Neo-Assyrian treaties. Like the heavens are going to be bronze and the earth iron.
Which we get there? No rain.
Yeah, which means you can't cultivate, there's not going to be rain. That is exactly like we found in some of the Assyrian treaties. Or that, you know, you're going to be so hungry, you're going to eat your own children. So there's certain curses that are kind of word for word similar.
But what you're saying, when it comes to the biblical blessings, cursings, or the Moses' assessment of number six, is that the blessings basically counteract the curses. If you do X, Y will...
No, the principle is if you follow the tree, if you follow the covenant,
you get both.
You will be blessed.
And if you don't, you get cursed.
If you don't, you will have these evil consequences. You will get
but
the curses.
Assyria says...
Assyria didn't bother with the blessings.
Doesn't bother with the blessings.
So if you want to compare Deuteronomy, you have to use Hittite and Assyrian.
Right.
Because the Hittite was an older form of treaty, and then the updated... superpower Assyrians just kind of simplified it and it became a bit more straightforward and top heavy. Like, we have more power, so we can enforce this even more. So that's all just to give a framework in your head. I think so far in Deuteronomy, we've kind of been looking at these two things. And we're kind of moving to the terms here, because we have our first big commandment, which is a kind of an all-inclusive commandment.
What year are we talking about now again? What year?
For what?
Deuteronomy, this written, the scripture.
Well, that is a tough question to answer. There are many opinions on when the final form of Deuteronomy was written down. So you could say that there's a core of Deuteronomy that goes way back, and then in its final form, it seems to be, first of all, for sure it's later than the other books of the Torah, because it even says that. I'm telling you the stories again, like this is the second Torah. But it is put as if it's Moses' speech. So let's say Moses gave an original speech, and there was like an original core, but it wasn't written down till much later. The fact that you have things that line up with Assyrian curses and not with Hittite would put it around the time when Assyria was big, which was, you know, 7th century. So, but when you get to biblical literature, you always have to be careful, because none of these books tell us when they were written. And most of them are preserving sources that go way back, and yet they were written down at a certain time later. Because a lot of this stuff was preserved orally for many years.
When it happened and written, could be quite a few years.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, that's true of the New Testament.
That's true of everything. Think of creation. Yeah. Nobody wrote anything down at creation. Yeah. So we have this story. When was that story written down? You know. So a lot of these things, you kind of have to take all dating with a lump of salt, because you use various ways to date a text. None of it is given to you. It's not like today where we have a copyright date, we have the author written down. In the Bible, it was very typical to have multiple authors also in one book. And they didn't have to say who they were.
Don't we believe about 6,000 years, something like that, is that what was thought?
In traditional Judaism, they start counting the world from creation, they get to 6,000, what if 500, whatever we are today.
78, isn't it?
Yes. But there are problems with that dating. Anyway, that's not our point. The reason I wanted to bring this up is because we have the Shema. It's a command. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. And we're going to talk about that. But then immediately after that first command, listen or obey, we have Ve'ahavta. And you will love. And so I wanted to remind us that love, the word le'ehov, to love, is treaty language. And these treaties I'm talking about, especially the Hittite, the head king is called the father. And he loves the son king. So they're using these metaphors of father and son. They're using love language. So that's why you can command someone to love you. Because what you're commanding is a faithfulness, a loyalty that you would naturally find in a family. That kind of loyalty they want from their subject king.
Covenant.
It's covenant. It's a covenant language. When you hear love, it's covenant language. Love the Lord your God.
Is it from the big king to the little king, or the big king to the people?
The big king is asking the little king to love him.
Oh, okay.
To be faithful to him. And to consider him like the father and the little king like the son. The other thing is, you know, we just finished it in Deuteronomy, but the 10 statements. Aseret hadibarot, Aseret hadibarot. 10 statements. We often call in English 10 commandments. But the fact that they're statements kind of lines up with this. The terms, their stipulations. These are things you need to do. Okay. So for us, I want to talk about the Shema statement, because it's really important, even though it's very common to all of us. And then talk about this threesome heart, soul, very. So the Shema statement is, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And in Hebrew, we don't have is. The verb in the present isn't there. So the way you can read this, it says, hear, Israel, Adonai, or his person, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, our God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, one. So you can read that, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, comma, the Lord is one. Or you could say, the Lord our God, comma, the Lord is one. But
say,
how...
Say that again. I've got, I mean, I can see it. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Eloheinu.
The Lord is our God. The Lord is one. Or essentially, the Lord, comma, our God, the Lord is one.
I got one translation, the Lord alone.
Okay. And then the question is, you know, what is one? But this, let me just point out something else. This is, you could say, the encapsulation of faith for Judaism, and you could say also for us.
Absolutely.
When it starts off, in text of the Bible today, if you read it in Hebrew, Shema, the last letter is big. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. So the word for one. Big Dalet. Does anyone know why? What?
Ad means forever.
Well, Ad means forever. Yeah, you couldn't take it that way. And there's actually, you know, you can have fun with this. But the other thing is Ed.
Oh, witness.
Witness.
Oh.
Witness. And in Greek, how do you say witness?
Martyr.
Martyros. Do you hear it? Martyr? Martyros? We all know in English what martyr means. The concept was that you witnessed to your faith. You were uncompromising to the very end. Even if someone was going to kill you, you still said your faith. And so, throughout history, if Jews were ever killed for the sake of being Jews, as they're dying, this is what they said. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. That is their witness. God is the Lord, God is one.
It started with the Christians.
It started with the Christians.
and then
they were dying for their faith.
Right. And then we end up at this song with the Shahid, which comes out of the Christian from martyr.
Yeah, so Shahid means also witness. It comes from the idea of martyr. And of course, Islam started after Christianity, and they had already seen Christian martyrs and Jewish martyrs. So this statement kind of encapsulates someone's faith. And it is revolutionary because nobody else believes in one God. I mean, you could argue there's one weird pharaoh down in Egypt who had this concept of one great God. But
so you have the first confession of monotheism.
First confession of monotheism. So how do you interpret it? The Lord is our God. You could say the Lord is our God and no one else's. And the Lord is one. That means there's only one God and there's no other God. So.
And that bothers the Jews, our three trinity.
Okay, I mean.
I'm not so sure.
He's one.
David, yesterday I was with a very orthodox Ethiopian family. And for some reason, something came up, I won't give the basics of it, and I said, You know, we have to understand who the Holy Spirit is. God is one, and I said, Shema Israel Adonai Lechem. I was talking Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Adonai Lechem, Adonai Echad. But God is also his Father. He gave us Yeshua, his Son, and he also gave us the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I pointed to one of the women. I said, in the same way as you are a mother, and you are an aunt, mm-hmm. and you're a sister,
right.
and you are whatever, a parent, grandparent, you're just chevra, you're one.
Yeah.
And that, the whole place took on a new whatever.
Hmm.
And it was the first time I mentioned Yeshua in that situation.
Yeah.
He is one.
Exactly. He is one.
I evangelize on the buses just for that thing, to mm-hmm. Orthodox and many different people. Also like steam. It's water, it's ice, and it's also...
Yeah, I mean, there's
right.
different metaphors.
Sharon, mm-hmm. where do you see exclusion in the Lord our God?
The Lord is our God.
Yeah, but how is that exclusive?
Well, this is a point of interpretation. The Lord is our God, what does that mean? Does it mean he's only our God?
Well, if he has
because if there choice. If there is only one God, and he's only our God, does that mean there's no God for the other people?
Like, she's only my wife, but there are other wives.
Because I want you to think about this, because I want to read the next section, and then also probably get to Romans 3 to discuss that. But... So leave that on the burner for a second. I want to just get to heart, soul, and very, because that's also important. The more I think about it, the more I think we really need to understand this better. Heart. 2 days ago was February 14th, and in many countries in like America, Britain, Europe, it's a day known as Valentine's Day, which is somehow a celebration of love, and I don't even know anything about St. Valentine's or why it's a big deal. There you go. It lines up with our text. If I knew more, I'd be able to say.
He's a good saint in Austria.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure he's so good. I think he was violent.
And I know in New Jersey, they sure celebrate it. They put up decorations just like it were Christmas. You know, hearts everywhere. Cupids and I don't know what.
It's what we call a Hallmark holiday.
But my point is heart. What is a heart and what does it do in the Bible?
It's to do with decision making and choosing. And
it's absolutely decision making and choosing. That is its predominant function is thinking. When in the phrase that somebody says in the Bible to talk to yourself, he said it to his heart. It's a thought process that's internal. Also, following God with your whole heart. It would be completely, your whole mind is following God. You have a phrase, if you want to look at 1 Chronicles 29. Let me see if I can read that for you.
1 Chronicles what?
1 Chronicles 28:9. This is David talking to Solomon. And you, Solomon, my son, da et Elohe avicha, know the God of your father, ve'avdehu belev shalem, and serve him with your whole heart. Wow. In English, I have a submissive attitude. All right. Verse 9. Uvenefesh hafetza, and a willing being, or they have here a willing spirit. Oh, nice. So I do have a translation note, with a complete heart and a willing being. There you go. For the Lord examines all minds. Oh, very nice. And guess what that word for mind is?
Lev.
All hearts. The Lord examines all minds. Still verse 9. Not yet. Verse 9, for the Lord examines all minds and understands every motive of one's thoughts.
Is it chapter 29?
It's 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 9. So the Lord examines all minds. The Hebrew there is heart. And all his motive, or the motive of his thoughts. And that word is yetzer machshavot. Machshavot today are thoughts. In the Bible, they're plans as well as thoughts. Okay. So the heart is the mind. Now this is going to get weird when you try to translate into Greek, because then we have a different thing going on, a different understanding of how things break down.
The soul is the mind, the will, and emotions. That's what I believe the soul is.
The soul,
the spirit, and the body.
So wait, so what's the heart?
The soul is the mind, the will, and emotions. And the mind.
So what is the heart?
The heart.
What is the heart?
The heart is the same. I mean, the heart, you can change, you know, intellectually, you get it in the mind. But if your heart's not changed, only the spirit can change.
Okay, so here's my problem with that. That dichotomy,
emotions.
That dichotomy is modern, is different than the Bible. There's no such thing as intellectual mind separated. The heart contains your decisions, and decisions are based on feelings. They are together.
That's the emotions.
Yeah, emotions and feelings are together.
The will. The will is to do the will of God.
So will, you could argue, is more nefesh. My point is simply that the heart contains your decision-making process, which is also motivated by feelings. Like, why do I like blue more than pink?
That's emotions.
Just, I happen,
it's
yeah.
A different word for the same thing.
There's nothing different about blue and pink. They're both valid, they're both equally moral, they're both whatever. My decision to prefer one over another is just how I feel about it, right? And so, decisions on many levels are still powered by emotions.
So you're basically saying that like the age of rationalism or the age of romanticism are, it's all contained within heart.
Yes.
Okay. Talking about how the Bible version, I mean, in its ancient context, that's
yeah, in Hebrew. So when you're asking someone to follow you with your whole heart, you're not asking for them to feel fluffy about you all the time. You're asking for them to consistently make decisions to follow you and to be faithful in that.
I love that this Chronicles verse because it says, the Lord searches all the hearts, understands all the intent of the thoughts, that's what you've done. If you seek him, that's your will. But that's still with the heart, isn't it? If you seek him,
yes,
he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. And it's that is actually a decision. It's not
it
just
is.
That you just sort of wander. It's a real decision. If you forsake something, you decide, I'm not going to drink
and
beer anymore, you're actually forsaking.
And there is an overlap. Like, you make your decisions, and then it needs to be powered by a deep-down
will.
There's got to be a deep-down drive. And I think that's where the nefesh comes in. If you look at Psalm 84:3, let's go there.
That's a really good sentence. Decisions are powered by will.
Okay.
Is that what you said?
Probably. Nichsefa vegam kalta nafshi lehatzerot Adonai. Okay, nichsefa is like, she longed. I have an English here in the NET Bible translation.
It's verse 2 in English.
Verse 2 in English, sorry. Psalm 84, verse 2 in English. I desperately want to be in the courts of the Lord's temple.
My soul longs, yet even faints.
Longs, yet faints. So what it is in Hebrew, it has this word for she longs, and also she's finished in the sense of, you know, like, I guess you faint, you collapse, you're overwhelmed with this longing. So they translate it, I desperately want to be in the courts of the Lord's temple. My heart and my entire being shout for joy to the living God. It's interesting. My heart, it says in Hebrew, and my flesh. So it's basically picturing here complete, completeness of being. But what I wanted to point out is that it's the soul, the nefesh, that is contains desperate longing. So the heart has emotion as well as your nefesh. Your nefesh has this deep set will and longing. However, in Hebrew, a nefesh is also any being. Like I could say, how many beings are in the room right now?
You could say that in English. So how many souls?
Yeah, but why can you say it in English? This is my theory. I haven't cross-checked it. I think it comes from the King James Version. Because many of our idioms in English came to us through a more literal Bible translation. So how many souls, or not a soul, was there? You know, you mean not a person,
yeah.
not a living being. And how many souls fell in battle? You know, you're talking about dead bodies. So the soul is kind of a very inclusive, I think the best translation for soul is being. It can refer to the physical being as well as this deep down, I don't know what you want to call it. Because to me, spirit and soul, I don't really understand any difference there anyway. I can't.
Well, does the soul contain the heart? If it's being, I mean, heart, willing, I mean, the way you describe.
Yeah, I think that there is an overlap.
But Deuteronomy 6 is making categories.
Deuteronomy 6 is making categories, and I would say it's trying to say everything. It's trying to include everything.
Right.
So your heart, which is already kind of inclusive, but you could say someone may interpret heart to be only your mental capacities. Then you throw in your soul, like that's a little more like your deep ambitions, your longings, your desires. And then you have your me'od. What is a me'od? How many have heard the word me'od?
It just very.
It means very.
Tov me'od.
Tov me'od, very. It's an adjective. So how do you serve God with all your very? What in the world does that mean? And so then you have to interpret. In every measure, or in to the utmost extent. With all your umph. So there are two popular translations. One is, well, how do you measure your everything? Well, money, your possessions. So love the Lord with everything you own. Yeah, there's some in Qumran. And the Greek, you want to keep talking?
No,
go for it. But come closer to the microphone, please.
These are the rocking chairs.
I'm thinking the difference between what animals and what God made in us. You know, if an animal had a heart but not a soul, or God made us so special. But
okay, so the other way to understand very is your strength, your physical strength. So all your whole extent of everything would include your strength.
And that's how today when we think of whether we regard heart, soul, and strength in English.
Heart, soul, and strength, or heart. The problem is when you get in Greek, you get mind.
No, but that's even later.
So then you get four. But those four are trying to understand just these three here. So in trying to understand these words, Greeks came up with four categories out of the three words.
So but it's interesting, isn't it? Because it repeats all the time, you shall do things with all your strength, which is with all your right?
What it repeats most often is your heart and your soul.
But
here we have and your very.
And your very.
Yeah.
So if then this very, this strength, does mean, it means it could mean anything. It can mean
it means everything.
Everything.
It means everything.
Whether it's your money, whether it's your
including your money and your strength and your time and your talents and every single capacity you have to the utmost.
Nothing left out.
Nothing left out. Nothing held back. Just everything.
Sounds like the kingdom of heaven.
Sounds like the kingdom of heaven, absolutely. That's why, you know, these several small verses are so iconic and so packed with information. Okay, so we are going to look now at Zechariah 14:9.
Before you rush, can I just say that when I was looking at this earlier, I saw these four all. This is what you're giving. It's not just in your head. It's not just once a week you spout it off. You're to teach it, you're to talk it, you're to mind it, you're to write it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, we're back at the mayor bit.
Yes. And one thing Deuteronomy continually reminds you of is that when you're following these laws, your kids are going to ask you why you do it. And that's when you need to explain to them. We used to be slaves in Egypt. God brought us out of there with a mighty hand. So you are you're retelling this historical event, this like major salvation event in history. And that's bound up with kind of like the more cyclical things that you do in a year. And so that's also pretty amazing, this concept of always having to reteach it and retell it, which means you're going to have to reinterpret it all the time because you're telling another generation.
But it also means we should be talking about what the Lord is doing in our own lives. And
absolutely. And identifying with his saving acts in history as if it was you. Like that's like been all through the Bible. Like the Passover Seder does a good job of that. I was in Egypt. God brought me out of Egypt. And of course, I myself, Sharon, was not in Egypt. Neither am I Jewish. So I'm removed from that historical act by two steps. And yet I can say it because I'm grafted in through Jesus' saving act, which was very much like that first saving act. And so I just found out my DNA yesterday.
We never talked about
yours.
And
I am shocked and surprised that I have 42% Swedish, because I've been raised to think I've been Norwegian my whole life. I do have Norwegian. I have 52% Norwegian, but there's 42 Swedish in there. I don't know how that got in there. So, anyway.
Duluth.
94%, let's just say Viking, Scandinavian, and a little bit of other stuff in there. So, definitely pagan. Out in the, what do you call it, the four corners of the world. So I'm living prophecy because I've been brought in and grafted in to this whole covenant. And God's special possession.
Zechariah
14. This comes after this description of this crazy event where the Mount of Olives is going to break into two and there's going to be this water that flows down. And then you get to verse 9. The Lord will then be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be seen as one, with a single name. Okay. Bayom hahu yihye Adonai echad, ushmo echad. So, there are many nice interpretations you could take this. It's very interesting that he's saying, in that day, God will be one and his name will be one. As if it's contingent on our reaction. But definitely, Zechariah, when he's saying these things, he's thinking the Shema in his head, right? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So if the name of God is one, and he is one, what does that mean?
And what's the context of Zechariah?
The kingdom of God, right? The Lord will be king over all the earth.
It's the day of the Lord.
Right.
It's more than that, isn't it? It's the Messiah kingdom of the future.
And Jerusalem's going to be set up to be secure forever.
Jerusalem's being attacked right now.
Right.
And they're being attacked by all the Goyim.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's at the end, because in verse 3 is the Lord will as
right.
he fights in the day of battle. And then there's the famous verses about his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives and so on. So, and there's a sense then when you get to 9, the Lord is, I mean, he's basically doing what you say, like he's echoing the Shema in a very big way. But it's like a sort of a statement that at last, soft, you know, Israel will really be able to say, this is our God, he is one, he is...
And the reason is because everyone is worshiping him. Everyone is following
him.
So when everyone is enthroning God as the Lord, that is when he is truly one.
That's why they come to do Feast of Tabernacles.
Right.
Because they got beat.
Because they
got so,
they got
whooped. So Gary has been filling in... Can you sit here so we can hear on the microphone? Or does it... He's referring to Zechariah 14:16. Then all who survive from all the nations that came back to attack Jerusalem will go up annually to worship the king, the Lord who rules over all, and to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. But if any of the nations anywhere on earth refuse to go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord who rules over all, they will get no rain. Okay. If the Egyptians will not do so, they will get no rain. Instead, there will be the kind of plague which the Lord inflicts on any nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. This will be the punishment of Egypt and of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles.
It's a reflection of Isaiah 16:12, I think, where all the nations that don't serve Israel, just doesn't talk about
and it
Israel.
Reminds you of the Exodus, which
right.
was from Egypt.
Right.
But why else do you think he specifically mentions Egypt here? I'm thinking of something very practical. What is the curse of people, or curse, what is the bad consequence if you don't come up to Jerusalem to serve God?
No rain.
So how does that affect Egypt?
No.
Less food. The problem in Egypt is they have a really big river. It's called the Nile.
They don't anymore, the rest of that.
Well, nowadays maybe, but in the context of Zechariah, Egypt is stable because it's got a really big river and they can irrigate.
Right.
So even when there's no rain, they can still get crops.
Right.
So this has always been part of Egypt's power, part of its stability. So saying, hey, and if the Egyptians don't keep it, they will get no rain. But he's probably thinking, well, yeah, that's partially a bad consequence, but they need more. And so he's like, instead, there will be the kind of plague which the Lord inflicts on any nation. So not only will they not get rain, they will also get a plague. Okay, and then it describes how everything's going to be inscribed with holy, holy is the Lord. As if the temple has been extended to all Jerusalem. And now all of Jerusalem, every pot, every vessel, everything's holy and set apart to the Lord. So this kind of big vision in Zechariah.
Go back to verse 9 with the connection of the Shema.
So, back to verse 9 with the connection of the Shema. Maybe, Gary, do you want to read for us Romans 3?
Well, let's just read the verse 9.
Read verse
9
one more time. The Lord will then be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be seen as one with a single name. And obviously, will be seen has been filled in for you in the translation.
And so what was Deuteronomy 6:4? Hear, O Lord.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So, Zechariah is saying, he's making this statement of the Shema universal. He's saying when God rules over everyone, then he's really going to be the one ruler, the one God. He'll be king over all the earth. And that's why I was mentioning before, how do you interpret the Lord is one? The Lord is our God. Well, what does that mean for other people? And so this is a question that all Jews have had to grapple with through history. If we are God's chosen possession, what does that mean? What does that mean for other people? Because there's one God. Now, if you had many gods, you could say, well, God is our God, and other people have their gods. Solved. But if you have one God...
You choose. You have to choose your God. We're not automatons. He's not just...
Yeah, but let's say if you believe there is only one God, then how does that one God relate to everybody? That's the question, right? And so we have statements like, we know, well, I'm speaking for Israel now. Israel knows that God is their God.
Right.
And Israel knows that God is one God.
Right.
So, and they know that they're somehow chosen to be this special possession,
yes,
to be a light to the nations. But what does that imply? And what does that mean? What is God's relationship then to the rest of the nations? He's obviously their creator. And here you have in Zechariah this picture that at one point, all the nations are going to come and worship God.
So like last Shabbat, we talked about the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, when all the nations are coming in to follow Jesus. Do they need to become Jews, right? Do they need to take on the Jewish faith, and or how does it fit together, right? So that's where they come up with Acts 15's kind of decision of you don't have to eat kosher and stuff
right.
like that. And then Paul goes to Greece, to Athens, right? And he comes to that altar to the unknown God, and he starts to give a reason to explain how this is talking about, you know, the God of Israel, you know, through Jesus. But there's all these gods out there, and so then you come to Romans, where Paul's writing the Roman church, who are Gentiles. I mean, there's some Jews probably there, but in general, the letter is about Gentiles and how they fit into the whole Jewish
scenario.
So,
yeah.
Romans 3.
So this big question in Paul's day is not the question most of Christians ask today. But it needs to change, because if we're reading these texts, the New Testament, as they were given, we need to change our question to reflect Paul's question. And the question was, do Gentiles have to become Jewish in order to worship God? That was a question. Because it's obvious that Jews are Jews, and that Jews will worship God, including the Jews who accept Jesus. What's not obvious is what to do with all these Gentiles.
And is the role of the Jew diminished because you've got all these other people coming in? And that's part of the, what do you have to do to be part of the kingdom of God? Do you have to be Jewish? Maybe not so, but then what does that mean for the Jews? Here's relationship with this covenant. Is that diminished somehow? Or if the other people don't have to follow it, what's the deal?
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of it?
Sure.
Yeah, that's part of the tension there.
I mean, historically, that's how it's played out.
If being part of God's people historically was that you bind yourself to this covenant and you follow these stipulations, then how can it be that someone can have a covenant with God and not be part of that? And
I think it goes back further, which is the fact that we've lost the name of God. It's Yahweh who is our God. You're to love Yahweh with all your heart, with all your soul, and so on. And then we're talking about this particular God, Yahweh, he's the God of Israel. And he makes certain stipulations and so on and so on.
Why does the name have anything to do with that?
Because all these other gods, I mean, they're either an unknown god or they're the Hindu gods. They've all
right.
got names of sorts of things. There are masses of gods out there. So which god do you serve? I serve Yahweh.
Okay,
God,
but then you can counter, if there is only one god, there's only one god. And whether you know his name or still just one.
Well, I think he's the one in the sense that he is the main one. He's the creator. There is no other god like you. He's above
right.
all the other gods. I mean, the Psalms are full of it.
Right.
So he's one God. He has this name, which we sadly sort of really abandoned. And there are umpteen other gods. Oh,
somebody's name, though, in the Bible, the name, it's your reputation. It's your character. It's who you are.
Yeah, but
it's not just saying the syllables of your name right. Like, if
right.
you call me something completely different or you butcher the pronunciation of my name, it doesn't matter as long as you know you're talking to me and you know who I am.
You have a relationship.
If you say I'm doing this in Sharon's name, it means you're doing this according to the kind of person I am and what I would decide.
That's right.
You know, so it's not about knowing my name perfectly.
I still think...
When I evangelize, I say to them, no, you're Muslim or Orthodox or whatever. I said, what died in the garden? I know the Quran talks about the Adam and Eve. And what died in the garden is the spirit, is a relationship with this living God. And this living God that created you, he created you for something. He created you to do good things, to think good, to be good.
Right.
And when they understand that, and I says, you know, the other one, Islam and all these other, they want to kill you if you don't obey or like their God, you know.
Right.
I says, no, it's this God.
Yeah, there's a character difference.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then he loves you because he created you for certain things.
Right.
And, you know, you can go on, the ones that are even in the spirit are born again. It has books in heaven that he already told us
okay.
what we should be doing.
So... back to our immediate text, Romans 3, verse 29.
What if we read a few verses before?
Okay. Where do you want to start reading? The 27.
How about I start at 23?
Okay.
For all have sinned, this is Romans 3, 23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, but they are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. God publicly displayed him at his death as the mercy seat accessible through faith. This was to demonstrate his righteousness because God in his forbearance had passed over the sins previously committed. This was also to demonstrate his righteousness in the present time so that he would be just and the justifier of the one who lives because of Jesus' faithfulness. Where, then, is boasting? It is excluded. By what principle of works? No, but by the principle of faith. Principle of faith. For we consider that a person is declared righteous by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of the Gentiles too? Yes, of the Gentiles too. Since God is one. God is one. He will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith.
Okay. So this is really foundational to Paul's whole concept of, I mean, everything he's writing about. God is one. And if that is true, if God is one, that means he's got to be God for Jews and for non-Jews.
Deuteronomy 6.
And it goes back to Deuteronomy 6.
And Zechariah 14. 9.
So yes, he is our God, but he is also the God of all creation. And yet, God set apart Israel for a certain role in salvation history. There's a certain calling he had for them. And in that sense, they are distinct.
It's interesting because in my verse English of Romans, I've got, or is it good?
Verse 30.
Since there is one God who will justify the serpents, it's not doing a direct, in my English, doesn't have a direct quote of Shema Israel or.
Well, you could say, since God is one.
It doesn't say that.
What's it say?
Since there is one God.
Yep. He's quoting from Deuteronomy 6.
I'm sure he is, but it's not really translated.
Okay,
very well.
So what he's saying, if it's really true that there's one God, then he will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised faith.
That's right.
So both ones are justified through faith, circumcised and uncircumcised, which means Jew and non-Jew.
What's kind of cool is Zechariah 14 talks about the Gentiles coming up to Jerusalem to worship the Lord, and like this morning, there's a few Gentiles in this room who are in Jerusalem, and it's kind of like
here we are.
Yeah.
And then immediately he says, "Do we then nullify the law through faith? Absolutely not. Instead, we uphold the law." And that's verse 31 is I guess a verse many Christians like to jump over. So this is Paul's mystery to me. You know, how can there be this situation? But I think it all goes back to salvation being based on historical acts. There was an exodus, and it did happen to certain people. And there was a person, Abraham, and he was one person, you know, and then out of that, all these things happened. But, like, God's always calling the one, the individual, and making something out of it. And they're, like, milestones, you know, salvation milestones in history that you point back to. And, you know, that's the way he's worked. And so Jews were called to be set aside and to uniquely show a relationship with God in a world where nobody else had it. And today we can be joined into that. So joining into that doesn't cancel all of that all of a sudden. It's simply joining in. And the mystery part was that we could join in without becoming Jews. That's the mysterious great part. So it was never asking Jews to not become Jews. It was saying Gentiles didn't have to become Jews. That's the part we miss because over history, the believers in Jesus became more and more Gentile only. And so then they read these texts with Gentile eyes and through events in history, and the whole question got flipped on its head. Okay, so that's enough. I've already gone over my time. Shabbat shalom.
May I ask a question about your own personal opinion?